It's hard to believe now that there are no women news readers, no women editors of anything in the news field, except for areas like the women's page or education or things that came out of domesticity, really. It was a sort of divided world. Even though so many women worked, work was seen as a men's area, you know, and private life was seen as a women's area. We aim to put an alternative women's news magazine on the newsstand. It was an alternative women's magazine, a monthly with 48 pages. My name is Marcia Rowe, and I worked on Oz magazine in Australia, Vogue Australia, Oz magazine in London, Ink newspaper in London, and then started Spare Rib with Rosie Boycott in 1972. It ran for 20 years until 1993. I was born in Sydney back in 1944. It's a very different place from what it is today. I grew up in a very conformist era where the first rebels I came across were the three guys doing a magazine called Oz, which came out in 1963 in April Fool's Day. I ended up with a job there, and that changed my life. I then worked for Vogue Australia, where I learned a lot more about production and how magazines were put together. With my radicalism awakened, that wasn't really a career for me, and I didn't see any way out of the secretarial slot. I mean, only 2% of women went on to further education in Sydney in those days. I decided to follow most of my friends who'd come to London, which was then the mecca of pop culture. And so you come to England, and there's this terrible class inhibition and these terrible conditions of life. And there was a feeling that these freedoms we'd gained as women were not enough, and we were still stuck in these supportive roles to men. So suddenly there was this new light, as it were. Hey, we can do something about our own lives, and we can make a difference. So it was incredibly exciting, and we were full of optimism, and, you know, we were going to go through every hurdle and find a way forward. That's why we could start on so little money. We thought we will find a way. Really, the underground press was the only way the counterculture communicated its own ideas with itself and with a broader public. The underground press did not give many women a voice. Certain women, Germaine Greer, wrote for it, but it was very much a male point of view. It was a male world. Well, we did achieve many freedoms though in the 60s. Certainly sexual freedom, but in a way that was overdetermined. Someone called Micheline Wonder, who was poetry editor at Time Out, and in those days Time Out was part of the counterculture, suggested having a meeting of women who worked in the underground press. I said to my friend Louise Ferrier, who, yeah, let's do it. And I rang everyone up I knew, women on IT and women on Friends, and we had a meeting in her basement flat, or the basement she shared with Richard Neville, who's the editor of Oz. It snowballed from there. It was Rosie Boycott, who'd been on Friends a few months, who said she'd go ahead with me. Because of having to do a lot of money raising for the Oz trial and to start Inc., I had all these contacts. There were all these, radical literary agents, theatre agents, people working in television, gallery owners who were willing to give money to these causes. We didn't raise what we thought we should raise. We did a very careful budget. We were going to be, you know, very professional. Unlike sort of Oz that came out when, you know, they had enough material. I thought we had to be a monthly magazine. And news wasn't sort of seen as a women's area, but we thought we would incorporate a news section. Guardian actually was ahead of its time in a way by having a women's page, because at least it had that. But it was, you know, as one women protester at the time said, you know, it was as if women were a special interest group to have just a women's page. The art editor who designed the basic grid and designed the logo was Kate Hepburn, who had been a girlfriend of Piers Marchbank, who designed Time Out, and they'd both been students at the Royal College of Art when it was going through its rebellious phase. Kate was really interested, and then I knew someone called Sally Doust, who in fact was English, and she and her husband Richard Doust come out to Sydney and worked on Vogue Australia. So I knew Sally, and she'd just had a baby. So this was her way of returning to work. So we had a sort of design team. A lot of the early issues were content that I'd got through asking women I knew. I already knew Michelin Wonder. I'd met Sheila Rowbottom. My friend David Widgery wrote for Oz magazine. So she'd started, been instrumental in calling the first Women's Liberation Conference in Ruskin. She was a historian. So she began writing. Someone called Deborah Allard, whom I knew from Sydney, contributed cartoons, who in fact then married Kenneth MacMillan. Angela Phillips, I think I met Angela Phillips at an abortion conference. I remember going up to ask her. I mean, you didn't see women photographers. And she was there taking photographs of this conference. So I went up to her and said, you know, are you interested in this idea? So she took the photo of the first issue. Someone to sell advertising, and Marion Fudger came in to spare rib from Record Mirror. She later went on to edit Music Pages. And then there was Rose Addis, straight down from Oxford University, who did production. She went on to do reviews, and then again in the first few months, Rosie Parker, who became the arts editor and was with Spare Rib for a very long time. These women were just followed by an amazing number of brilliant women over the next 20 years who made Spare Rib what it was. And it was very much the idea of making it look like an ordinary women's magazine, not being shocking, but it was to have a completely different content. So we did have cooking, and we had this wonderful practical page at the back about how to mend your own shoes or put up shelves, because women were incapable of putting up a shelf. This is one of the jokes. And someone called Stephanie Gilbert did these immaculate drawings and really clear instructions. So there was a real practical side. It wasn't theory-based, and nor did it look like local radicalism. It was magazines were like, to me, were like a best friend. They could inspire you and give you some imagination. So we had short stories, and I thought, well, we're not going to get millions of ads. How are we going to bulk out this magazine? I thought if we do our news pages on a matte paper, differentiate them from the features and the other glossy content, you know, it will help bulk the magazine out. We could not afford four-colour printing, but you could do amazing things with two colours as well as black and white, which is what Sally and Kate did. I mean, there was one very short period when we went into four-colour, but we couldn't carry on with that. And it did look completely startlingly different on the newsstands to any other women's magazine. There were photos of women on the cover without loads of makeup. Well, in those days, it had gone away from the hair set look, or there was a sort of natural look of women from the 60s. But you still got women posing in a very vacant stare, or a lot of false eyelashes, all that. Very glamorous. So these were women who just looked like themselves. And there was a sort of energy to that. It's not that we were against, we had makeup page. Actually, the first woman who did it was another Australian woman called Julie Reuter. We had jeans as our first fashion, double page spread on jeans. Not a single magazine ever featured jeans. This was unheard of. The first time jeans came on a Vogue cover was Anna Wintour in the 90s or something. Post 1975, women's movement was sort of accepted nationally. There'd been more legislation passed. But in that very early period, women's liberation was seen as a laughing subject, you know, or a silly woman's libber, you know. Feminism was threatening. And I think because we wanted to be acceptable in a newsstand, we walked a sort of strange path between not being too outrageous, but yet having content that was... I remember in issue number 8, you know, we had the first piece, really, that actually interrogated the male gaze. It was by Laura Mulvey, and she was looking at the work of Alan Jones, and she was saying, you know, how do we look at these paintings are not about women at all. They're really about men and men's fears. And women are actually absent, even though they depict women. And so we did do all these radical ideas, but it was also on the magazine, women weren't all consciously feminist, as it were. We were still trying to change the language. We were fighting through these ideas for ourselves. We were learning new things. We were reflecting what was going on in the women's movement, the debates, the intense debates that the women's movement was having. My idea was always that Spare Rib would reach out to other women around the country, and most women's liberation literature I picked up at the conference, or something like Shrew, which was brought out by a small group, spoke to women who already knew about, you know, women's groups, or I'd found a new world through Oz magazine. I thought, well, Spare Rib can be a way for other women to find, you know, a new world for them and for us. And that really did have an effect. I mean, our first issue, we had an article called The First Cow in Chiswick High Road, and actually it was about the first women's centre and how women had sent that up. So that was the very first piece in the national press, really, about a women's refuge. And that was startling. You know, in those days, it really, domestic violence was blamed on women. You know, you brought it on yourself. And then I remember going to Australia a few months later for a quick visit, and they'd read about that in Spare Rib, and they set up a women's refuge in Sydney. And part of what we had called spare time was listing women's groups so that other women could get in touch with other women to start a group if they wanted to. We published news on equal rights and the developments in achieving legal equality in the news section. There was an environmental piece. Women would be really informed about campaigns through the magazine, and then maybe they would want to start up their own local campaign, and they could ask other women to join them through that. I still meet women to this day who had to hide their magazine from their husbands, you know, stick it down behind the bookcase. And the country itself was in some sort of turmoil. There were miner strikes for better paying conditions, which meant that we had to be careful about energy use. So I remember we were writing the first questionnaire, what women like to see in Spare Rib, through with candlelight. The candle stuck on top of the typewriter, and I remember the red candle sort of dripping down the typewriter. There were sit-ins, the Clyde sit-in, there were miner strikes. Then in 73, there was the oil crisis and the three-day week. Back in 71, there was a huge garbage strike. London was full of uncollected garbage. And so I think there were a lot of women in left radical groups who were involved, and there was a lot of pressure on women from those groups not to put women's interests first. They would talk at conferences, but they, you know, putting women's interests first, putting our own interests first, was, again, incredibly energising. And you're always breaking new ground. I remember Sarah Maitland standing up at a conference at Ruskin in Oxford about history, and all these men, a lot of men had been talking about history, and women were seen as sort of footnote. And she said, no, you know, we have to look at history in a completely radical different way. And that was, I was sort of dynamite, you know. And there were no women's studies at that time. This was the beginning of trying to think about how the world looked from a woman point of view, and that would go back through the ages. In fact, most conferences had a strong history element, rewriting history, looking again at history. And I tried to bring that into the magazine. Well, the first underground newspaper in this country was IT, with Barry Miles. And there were local presses all around the country, Leeds, Manchester, Bristol. The Underground Press Syndicate started from Village Voice in America. So there was a free flow of this alternative news, really, throughout the world. I mean, it went to Europe. I mean, it was America. It was places like Australia. And you felt it was us against them, us against the establishment, putting the voice for an alternative way of looking at the world. There were concerns about the environment. It was anti-Vietnam War, and it was about, you know, sexual freedom and a different consciousness. And then there was a feeling at the end of the 60s that was unsustainable. A lot of magazines, like Oz magazine, relied on record advertisements, and there was a feeling that the music business, which had all been part of it, this youth culture, was now being taken over by big business. Sometimes they would then start wanting to put their music ads in the actual music press rather than the underground press. However, I mean, for instance, Spare Rib benefited from things like distributor Moore Harnesses really started distributing all these underground press publications. There were articles in the trade press at the time of launching Spare Rib where they said, well, you know, the underground press may be losing its energy, but we'll have to see if Spare Rib is picking up that baton. At first, there was some suspicion about Spare Rib from some elements of the women's movement, you know, question, you know, who were these odd people from the underground press, which was seen as sexist, you know, what were women from there going to bring out? And it was attacked. 1975 or so, it was seen as a public voice for the women's movement, and there was not a sort of division between activism and women doing exploratory new things. And so there was a constant flow of communication. And if we wrote about what one particular group was doing, it would be quite important to put an editorial look at it. You know, you don't want a group writing about how wonderful it was when really it was only achieving half of what it wanted to do. Or so you had to use your editorial sort of perspective. The content of Spare Rib did change quite a lot from the beginning. It moved rather away from the women's magazine model, and a lot of the practical aspects were really sort of dropped as time went by. And as the women's movement grew, and there was more positive interest in particular types of activism, and those subjects took centre stage. After a decade, I mean, my initial feeling of you must always try and have a dialogue with the reader and go beyond specific women's movement demands or specific women's movement audience to outside that. In order to carry on being appealing as a magazine, that really went by the way. A decade later, it became, in a way, more politically focused. And although you might say the personal is political, in a way that was narrowed. And I think that, in the end, maybe it was a strength at the beginning, and but it did help encourage the demise of Spare Rib 10 years later. Because without that outward-going aspect and that demand that you carry on being interesting as a magazine per se, you start to have a dialogue only with people who are already persuaded. And I mean, there were very important arguments going on about racism and identity, but the audience for it was smaller and smaller and dwindling. And of course, also by the end of the 80s, a very anti-feminist mood of the country. Everyone thought women's movement had done what it was going to do, and it wasn't going to, you know, feminism was a dirty word by then. So it had gone through two decades of change. I think in terms of the look of the magazine, to the sort of revolutionary daring of Kate and Sally and their particular skills and genius at making the magazine look special, were rather dropped. But on the other hand, you know, there were more and more women photographers and cartoonists coming along, and whereas a lot of men had contributed visually to the early issues, and within a few years it was only women, you know, only women photographers. I mean, I still love the object that I hold in my hands. I tend not to read women's magazines anymore. I was very pleased to see the way women's magazines evolved, and they started having inside them really everything Spare Rib would have had inside them, or where Spare Rib broke new ground. With the internet, there's always someone else who can also can control it. Look at all the issues about fake news. So in a strange way, the little print medium may have an independence, an authenticity that can be guaranteed.